And now, it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It's 4 minutes past nine on this Tuesday, the 16th of September 2025. How are you all keeping? I do hope you're very well indeed. We've got a very interesting show, some interesting conversations, some important conversations. We've got community garden information, of course, and we're going to keep you up to date with the stories really behind the headlines here on the programme. We invite and welcome your comments and interactions with us, however you choose to do so. Of course, you can WhatsApp and text us, including WhatsApp voice notes, by the way, if that suits you, to 086 60 25000. Give us a call either on 07491 25000 or email comments at highlandradio.com. And just to remind you, if you're watching on the... if you're listening, sorry, to the podcast or listening to the overnight repeat, your views are as equally important, right? So you can email comments at highlandradio.com or even WhatsApp and we'll retain them and carry them over to the next live show. And of course, if you want to watch the show, and it's always a very visual show, most of our guests join us either via video or in studio. You can watch us at home or wherever you are on your smart TV or your Fire Stick. We're on the YouTube app. Just search Highland Radio Ireland. We're on Facebook, across our Facebook pages, except for some reason, the Highland Hub page today, it seems to be playing up for us. Not much I can do about that at this point, but we are on X as well. And there's also a Watch Live button on our website, right? So that's all the ways. There's no excuses, effectively. Unless you're actually genuinely trying to avoid us, you'll find us somewhere or other. Right, we are heading into the winter. We're heading into a winter whereby we are seeing an increase in people struggling. I mean, obviously, you know, they say the country is wealthy and there are wealthy people in it and there's a lot of money being saved, but there's a great deal of our population who are struggling to make ends meet. And of course, this is a very expensive time of the year. 220,000 of our children are living in poverty. So that doesn't really be, that wouldn't be an indicator for me for a rich country anyway. But what help might be there for people in the winter? Well, pressure is growing on government to pay energy credits again in this budget. This is in the Irish Independent. The pressure is on government to pay energy credits in next month's budget, and it's piling up after a new survey found a majority of people see the payment as a top priority. Most cite energy costs as their main worry ahead of the budget. Some 57% of people rank retaining energy credits and extending VAT reductions on energy as their top priority for budget 2026. This according to polling data from the Amarac Research of Dublin-based Rockwood Public Affairs. This will increase pressure on the government to offer some respite from the rising costs in the form of another round of energy credits to offset electricity and gas bill hikes. That being said, there aren't any electricity hikes or gas hikes, for that matter, proposed by the biggest electricity provider, but that's not in any way to say we don't need them. The government has insisted there will not be an additional cost of living package in the budget. It comes as reports indicate that the third level student fee is likely to be reduced by up to €500 in the budget. So that's something. There is also growing talk of a second child benefit payment for those most poorly off, which would be targeted. It would be something I'd welcome. If they're not going to do something generally, and what's the point in giving, you know, rich people money off their electricity bill? They really should look at spending whatever money they have on those that need it most, and there certainly is ways of targeting it. The Irish Times reports that a man is to stand trial charged with alleged arson attacks on a church and two halls in Donegal. Ryan McCrabb, who's at 20 of McCann's Corner, St. Johnstone, appeared before Letterkenny District Court this week and was served a book of evidence. The three charges follow a series of fires at buildings in the east of the county, in the east of the county village on August 29th last year. You'll remember them. We carried details of them extensively here and the reaction to them and the appeals to try and find the person responsible. Well, Mr. McCrabb is charged with committing arson at the Royal Orange Hall, Main Street, St. Johnstone, contrary to Section 2 of the Criminal Damages Act 1991. He's also charged with the same offence on the same date at St. Bathan's Church, St. Johnstone. And he's also charged with committing arson at St. Johnstone Masonic Hall, Church Lane on the same date. Garda Gillian Page told the court Mr. McCrabb made no reply when the book of evidence was served on him in court yesterday. The accused man did not speak during the short hearing. All of the papers have an image of Deputy Owen Hayes. He's a controversial character to begin with, but he's wearing brown makeup, and it is part of a Halloween costume, in inverted commas, where he was trying to emulate Barack Obama. As I say, it's in all the papers, the front of the Irish Daily Mail, in fact. Controversial Social Democrats TD Owen Hayes dressed in blackface, as it's called, at a party in 2009. Mr. Hayes appeared as Barack Obama in full blackface at the Halloween bash in Cork City. The TD was only allowed to re-enter the Social Democrats parliamentary party 2 months ago after admitting that he misled the public about his shares in a company working on Israeli military projects. In a statement to the Irish Daily Mail last night, Mr. Hayes said he was profoundly sorry and accepted his blackface Halloween outfit was racist. The fresh controversy comes as the Social Democrats meet for their parliamentary party thinking in Dublin today. And effectively what they're saying, and what a return it is for that party's leader who's been on maternity leave, what effectively they're saying is that this is not a sackable offence, that he went on to work for Barack Obama or his campaign, so that indicates that he's not this, that or other, but also too that this was of a time. Now, at that time, he was the head of the students' union in the college that he was attending, and he was 22. So, you know, 22, you should know what's what at that age, shouldn't you? But that being said as well, 2009, was it a different environment? He says he didn't even know it was offensive, really. Maybe it's not. I do note, like, even to this day, there's a Hispanic lady that does, and she's incredibly popular on TikTok, for an example, but she's an Hispanic lady with darker brown skin, and she does whiteface, as you could describe it, to impersonate and mock the religion, you could say, of the Donald Trump's press secretary. So it's still ongoing, but it's in reverse, and it's, you know, it's not seen this as bad. But that being said, this is a no-go because of history. But what effectively, Ms. Hearns was saying, that if this was last week or, 2 years ago, he'd definitely be out of the party. But because it was 2009 and because he's pled ignorance, then it's not a sackable offence. So there you go. There's a couple of trains of thought on this. 2009, a long time ago, 22. If everyone wanted to deep dive into any of our backgrounds, could they find something, you know, that looks absolutely brutal now that might not have looked as brutal then? That being said, I can't imagine I'd ever do this. But anyway, you know, everyone kind of maybe has a skeleton in the closet that if it was exposed and shown in a certain light. So do you have sympathy for him or not? You know, maybe put politics to a side. Often, you know, when we discuss things like this, it's always framed in what our own political beliefs are. But do you think that, you know, it's a long time ago, get over it, he didn't realise it, or I suppose as well, you know, you have to throw in his poor decisions maybe in relation to his shares in that Israeli company or that company that benefited from Israel. Maybe it's just one mistake in inverted commas too far. If you have any views on that, and you may not, I don't think the Sock Dems are massive up here, but anyway, 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number. Just a bit more of an update on the story we were talking about yesterday, and this is concerns that a case that has been taken might see drink driving prosecutions chucked out. Thousands of drink driving prosecutions could be rescinded after a court ruled there is a problem with the legal system's blood and urine test regime. The shock possibility of throngs of overturned convictions has resulted from a case of a man who was found guilty of drink driving and got a 2-year ban. His solicitor claimed the verdict issued and should be overturned due to an inability to prove that his blood sample could not have been tampered with after the arresting Garda posted it for analysis. A judge agreed, overturning the driver's conviction and a driving ban, and ruled that the law is flawed and said it's up to the state to address it. Now, the Director of Public Prosecutions is expected to challenge the court ruling after the judge's ruling takes effect next month. But legal sources have warned of massive consequences as blood and urine samples are used in up to 7,000 drink driving court prosecutions every year. The controversy began in August 2012 when Gardaí asked the male driver to provide a blood specimen, and on the story goes. The law has to be challenged. That's how we know it's fair. That's how we know it stands up to vigour. So there will be potentially more people in the in this part of the world, in the law industry, challenging it. But if that is not upheld, it might make it very easy for many of these 7,000 a year drink driving cases to be overturned. Still wall-to-wall coverage on American news channels of the assassination of right-wing spokesperson, campaigner, conservative campaigner. He called himself conservative, he called himself right-wing, Charlie Kirk. His suspected killer is in custody, and the FBI and other agencies over there are really revealing more details about him. Actually, it's quite notable. I see Taylor Swift, she went to a football match to see her husband or future husband play behind a 7-foot shield. So anyone in the public eye, especially, you know, with the potential for sniping, etc., they're up to high dough. You can see they're up to high dough. So she's walking around effectively in public, in big spaces with this 7-foot-high bulletproof shield. What a way to live your life that would be. You know, you can keep your money. I don't think I would be interested in living my life like that. But anyway, Charlie Kirk's suspected killer, Tyler Robinson, wrote a note vowing to take out the right-wing activist. It emerged yesterday. FBI Director Kash Patel said it was found in the house where Robinson lived with his transgender partner Lance Twiggs. The note itself had been destroyed, but its chilling message was recovered by forensic experts. It's basically saying, I have the opportunity to take out Charlie Kirk and I'm going to take it. Now, he also apparently was part of a big Discord group, where he was, as it turns out, it was mostly populated by members of the transgender community. But there is some suspicion that he had told them in advance that this is what he was going to do. And the state in which this crime happened, those people, if they did have knowledge and didn't let on about it, could face very, very serious charges. And the Ploughing Championships is possibly as popular as ever, isn't it? The weather's going to be mostly dry today, but I'm going to read the article here in the Irish Daily Star because the papers love to exaggerate, exacerbate and poke and prod with weather forecasts. Punters are set to brace for torrential downpours over the course of the 3-day National Ploughing Championship as the festival kicks off today. Yellow rain warnings are officially in place for Clare, Cork, Kerry, Limerick and Galway for today and tomorrow, but Offaly is still expected to be struck by a deluge or two. It starts to sound a little bit better the deeper you get into the article. This as the annual pilgrimage to All Things Farming begins, with around 250,000 attendees expected at what could become a mud bath. Okay, well, if you're heading down, enjoy, drive safe, have fun. We might be hooking in with a reporter down at the Ploughing Championship to get a sense of what's going on. Obviously, there's going to be a sort of a political element to it, firstly, because of the geopolitical situation and how it affects exports, etc., but also to potential presidential candidates landing down to press the flesh and shake hands. You know, they shake hands. If you become a presidential nominee, you shake hands very delicately. You're very soft and you almost say, please take my hand. And then you get the other hand and you cup it on that hand, and that's the presidential handshake. It just shows you sincerity and, you know, your humbleness. That's my experience of it anyway, which is fine. All right, that was a run through some of the news headlines today. Let's get more news going after we take a quick break. The first ever trial of a former British soldier accused of murder during Bloody Sunday began in Belfast this week. Soldier F is accused of murdering James Ray, 22, and William McKinney, 26, as well as 5 counts of attempted murder in 1972. 13 people were shot dead by the Parachute Regiment when it opened fire on civil rights demonstrators in the Bogside area of Derry. 15 others were wounded. The non-jury trial is taking place at Belfast Crown Court, where Soldier F is screened from public view by a black curtain around part of the dock. The former paratrooper, whose identity remains protected by a court order, has entered pleas of not guilty. He also denies the 5 counts of attempted murder. We're joined on the programme now by Mickey McKinney, who is William McKinney's brother. Thank you for joining us, Mickey. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm just glad that we're at the stage that we're at. It's taken us a long time to get here, but we're here now, and we have to get on with it now.
Did you think this day would arrive, Mickey, where someone would actually, stand trial for the murder of your brother?
From after the inquiry, from we got the report of the inquiry, and then the police investigation. You know, our solicitors were in touch with the police, and they put it to them, right, well, what are you going to do about this? So there was a police investigation, and it was more or less just progressive from then. But really, it was a day at a time. We had to see where we ended up. You know, at one stage, the public prosecution wanted to stop the case because of a ruling in the Joe McCann case in Belfast, which we judicially reviewed, and we won that. You know, so that was a big turning point.
What's your feelings about this person being able to maintain anonymity, being shielded from public view in the court? Does that matter to you?
Well, okay, I couldn't care and never see him, but what really matters is it's a disgrace, the protection this boy's been given. You know, he has carried anonymity from the inquiry. We seen him in Central Hall in London, and now he's screening out during this case. You know, it's really beyond belief, their protection at this man's getting, and we wonder why. We have our suspicions, but we wonder why.
Would it compromise? We don't want to do anything that could be used that could in any way compromise the trial. But can you divulge what your suspicions? Is it that you don't necessarily have faith in this process? Potentially.
Well, okay. Right. First of all, we don't trust the British government. I never did trust the British government. But the protection this man's been given is really just beyond belief. We think he's probably went through the ranks in the British Army and ended up in a very good position, maybe within the army somewhere. We're not exactly sure, but he's well protected.
But of course, if found guilty, that veil of anonymity falls, does it?
Oh, absolutely. I found guilty. That'll go. Tomorrow, we're not in court today, but tomorrow, Thursday and Friday, there'll be legal arguments on the admissibility of hearsay evidence, which places F. Anglin-Fanna Park firing his weapon. Now, the judge will probably take a few days to consider that. And next Wednesday, he'll deliver on it. So if he rules against it, if he rules it out, the case is over. But if he rules in our favour, okay, he goes to trial.
Yeah, so it's like everything, it's like this entire journey, everything sort of balances on decisions that you will always sort of question the motivation of. It's very frustrating.
It is frustrating. It's taken so long. You know, it's 15 years from we got the report, the Bloody Sunday report. It's 15 years since that, and we're only getting on the court now. Well, we've been on court with the trying out of witnesses and and this last couple of years, and lockdown certainly didn't help it any. But we're here now, and hopefully we'll get the right decision next Wednesday, and the thing will proceed to trial.
There's a couple of things that's very important. Obviously, on a personal level for the Ray and McKinney families, and obviously then, you know, there are other families that might feel now they'll never get justice. But that being said, if the trial does proceed, it will once again, and to a new generation, and I wonder how important this is to you, remind people of the events in those years in the early 70s that led to this massacre of people.
Oh, absolutely. I was there that day. I had just moved just before the powers come on. And what happened that day should never have happened. You know, it just should never have happened.
Can you talk us through, if you don't mind, talk us through your memories of that day?
Well, it would take a bit of time, but I can take myself to Roswell Street. I remember William Street was jammed up. The march was stopped at Barricade 14. They didn't let us under the Guildhall Square where we intended to end up and have speeches. But the march was stopped. There was a bit of rioting took place. I remember moving down Roswell Street. I remember passing by one of the flats and having a thought, I'll go back to William Street again to see if I can find some of my friends. Because the size of the crowd, you know, everybody, we all sort of lost each other. Mm-hmm. But I walked on down Roswell Street and I was standing at the edge at the entrance to Glenfarnock Park, where within the next 10 minutes, my brother and others were going to be shot and killed. I remember standing there and word filtering through the crowd that somebody was shot in William Street. That would have been Jared Donaghy Damien Donaghy and John Johnson. Mm. And across they're starting to fire on the gas, saying. And across over the street, it's just where the monument is today. And I met my gear friend then, you know, she was standing with her friend, and she knew my wife. And she said, yeah, the bells, I'm standing in the chapel grounds, and the bells are just going off again.
It's okay. If it doesn't distract you, they're not as noisy as they might be. So you can carry on, unless it's too distracting for you.
Not at all, no. We'll stop me in a minute.
Yeah.
But she suggested that we make our way to my aunt's house, which is just a couple hundred yards up the street, and St. Columb's Wales. Because we were being affected with the CS gas until the rally started at Free Dairy Corner, which is all within a couple hundred yards of each other, even less. But as we were making our way to my aunt's house, I remember turning around and seeing the army coming in on the Roswell Street. And you look, the Bogside and Craigan were no-go areas, Ian. And I've seen many days that there was riots went on, but the army never come on that far before. There was a big TK at Bedford, and there was a number of APCs, army personnel carriers. Mm. There was wee ferric here. And I thought, no, this is different. They're coming right on the Roswell Street. And as we just got on this in Columns, Wales, and going on to my aunt's house, everything just went crazy. I have no memory now of hearing gunfire, but everything went crazy. People were running round from the rally, round on the St. Columb's Wales, roaring and screaming in total panic. I got into my aunt's house, which is a wee small house, and it was packed full of people. And I remember somebody saying, and this is all within minutes, somebody saying there's six dead at the barricade.
Yeah.
And I thought, good God, you know. And then my brother George, the oldest brother, George would have been just under Wally.
Mm.
And he said, well, I've seen Joe there now. No, he says, I've seen Wally. He's a bit of a wonder where Joe was. So George left again, and then things calmed down. And my wife, or my girlfriend, Ann Grady, and I went to her house, and for tea. There was evening mass saying, and we went to mass, and the priest, Father Rennie, talked about the terrible events that afternoon. But what I didn't know until some time after, in fact it would have been years after, There was a fellow who used to work with Woolley and the Derry Journal, a fellow called Pat Clark. He was coming out behind me, coming out of chapel. It was him who informed my father that Woolley had been killed. And he couldn't tell me. I had to go home before my father had told me. I didn't know that until years after. Not that it mattered any.
It took a while to find out.
I said to Grady, I said, look, I said, I need to get home to let my mother far know that I'm okay. But the day before, there was two people from our street shot, Peter Robbs and Peter McLaughlin. And as we were approaching our house, we love him, Craigan. As we were approaching the house, I noticed Farm McLaughlin's car pretty close to our house. And I said to Grady, I said, well, there must be something wrong with Peter McLaughlin or Peter Robson. But as I went into the house was packed, and my father approached me. And I said, Wally's dead. And then I just fell to my knees and just broke down. My mother was sitting crying in the chair, and it was just crazy. It was just all crazy stuff. My father waking me the next morning with him crying. I never heard anyone cry as sore. And my older brother George trying to console him.
And in the years that followed... go ahead. Sorry, Mickey, please.
All the other families all had their own similar stories.
Yeah.
You know, like there was one family, the Nash family. His father was going out to his son, Wally Nash. He was shot dead at the barricade. Along with Megan McDade and John Young. Alec Nash, he was shot that day too. And their mother was in the hospital with a heart attack during the time, you know. So, and there was three families there following us. And then the British government, the next day, releases their what they wanted people to believe, that their troops engage with gunmen and air bombers. The New York Times printed it the following day that British paratroopers engaged with ARA and the Bogside that day and named all the day, itemizing each one of them as a gunman or an air bomber. And we were left chasing that lie for over 40 years.
Other than the loss of your brother, who obviously was very important to you, and then the distress, just, you know, seeing the distress in your dad and the rest of the stuff that was going on, was it the fact that they were framed effectively or their murders were misrepresented? Was that the most difficult part outside of the loss and the grief, the fact that they tried to drag your brother's name through the, you know, through the gutters effectively?
That was a big part of it as well. Okay, firstly, they took life. They murdered 13 people that day, and they attempted to murder a further 15. And then they libeled them. You know, as far as I'm concerned, the British government wrote the script. You know, they knew what they were doing. And it wasn't until some years after that I found out you can say whatever you want about the dead.
Yeah.
And you can't be brought to book for it. You know, and they slandered the British government and the British army, slandered my brother and everybody else who they shot that day. They slandered their names.
The one other question, what do you believe was the level of planning on that day or in the lead up to that day, or the intention, or do you, your personal belief, there's different records out there, or you know, did a group of fellas lose the run of themselves? Or what is your overriding sense of what happened that day and why it happened in the lead up to it?
I believe it was deliberate. You need to keep in mind the political situation at the time. Craigan and the Boxey was a no-go area. It was the only no-go area in Northern Ireland. It was the only place where the police or army couldn't go to. And because of the whole internment thing and all of that there, I believe that they wanted to teach nationalists a lesson. You know, why would they move their crack unit to Derry? You know, the march was contained. The march was contained by local soldiers. There was no need for paratroopers. A few years before the inquiry started, John Kelly and myself got a phone call from a man in Derry. He told us he wanted to speak to us. This man had been subpoenaed to the inquiry. And he told us that on the Tuesday, prior to Bloody Sunday, he got a phone call from somebody in London. And the message went, the powers are going on the Derry on Sunday and they're not going on the Eel Battens. And he contacted somebody in the Irish Army on the Saturday night and told them the message. And at half four on Sunday, he contacted the morgue and spoke to someone in the morgue. And he says, what's the situation there? And the person in the morgue told him at the morning, he says, there's six in front of me, 68 bodies in front of me. Mm-hmm. This man was on the bog at the time and he got a house with a phone. There wasn't many houses with phones in at the time. And he contacted this Sergeant McGonagall, who was on the Irish Army, who he spoke to the night before. He said, do you see what I was told you yesterday? He says, it's already happened. What happened in Bloody Sunday was deliberate.
And let me ask you also, in terms of, do you believe also the public relations exercise was pre-planned as well to put bombs and guns in the dead's hand, if you know what I mean? Do you think there was that level of premeditation that they would say, right, you know, this is going to blow up here. We need to make sure that so on and so forth.
Aye. I know where you're coming from there, but no, they didn't put guns in the dead's hand. What they did, they planted nail bombs and Ger Donaghy's.
Aye, but that Parker. Kind of stuff, do you know what I mean? Not literally, I'm on about in the public eye.
Oh, they knew what they were doing, of course. Ger Donaghy didn't have nail bombs on him. You know, it was a British army that did that.
Yeah, okay. Again, it's like one sort of hurdle you get to get over that, and then there's another hurdle and you get over that. I mean, this particular hurdle that you crossed Monday has been a long, long time coming. We'll see how things go on Wednesday, Mickey. But I really do appreciate your time and I hope you're so well. It's a stressful enough time as well, I'm sure. But thank you very much for joining us today. It's greatly appreciated.
Okay, thank you.
All right, goodbye. That's Mickey McKinney, whose brother William Willie McKinney was murdered on Bloody Sunday. Welcome back. We're joined on the programme now by James Sweeney. He's a PhD student at the ATU in Letterkenny. Good morning to you. How are you keeping?
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Right, now, what are you looking at as part of your studies?
So,
Part of your studies?
Yeah,
or
no,
it's okay,
part of the PhD. So yeah. I'll give you a bit of background. So it's transition from secondary school to university, and I guess what are impacting the mental health of students during that transition. So I'm going to give a bit of background, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
Just into kind of this came about. So my supervisors, so Doctors Margaret McClafferty, Louise McBride, and Elaine Murray, they worked on a previous project in Ulster University in LYT back in the day, and this was around 2019, and what they're looking at was the first year to the fourth year of university, and they tracked students from their first year to the fourth year and trying to see if there was any differences in their mental health. So what they found was at registration, students were really high mental health prevalence rates. They're coming in with quite high prevalence rates. A lot of them had...
Are you on about negative mental health?
Negative mental health. Sorry, when I say that there, sorry. But negative mental health rates in regards to anxiety, depression, and things like that there. But also a significant amount of them had already attempted suicide at that point, which is quite poignant to the fact that this is before university. So beforehand, we would have usually conceptualized it as universities where it might have been starting in terms of the mental health problems. So this was kind of a big shock. And as they traced those students throughout their first four years of university, they found that students in Northern Ireland had better mental health to start, but then it decreased. And then also those in the South had worse mental health to start and it increased. And they kind of met somewhere in the middle where they both weren't doing amazing, but they were also around the middle by the time they went on. So this inspired my supervisors then, especially Dr. Margaret McClaffrey, to go and apply for funding to try and further examine, first of all, what's going on? Because they're coming in already with this here mental health problems. As I said, it was before kind of thought it was in university they're forming.
So just in what kind of rates are we talking about? So say, for instance, where they meet in the middle, you know, what rate of or do we know maybe the
I'm trying to think off the top of my head. See, I wasn't involved specifically in that
no,
study,
I get
but
you, yeah.
I'm trying to I think it was... I'd say about 20-25% potentially.
So 75% of the student population we're talking of circa, and we're open to correction because we don't have the study. They're okay, right?
Yeah.
And then it's the 25% that are having sort of negative mental health experiences. It starts worse in the Republic and improves somewhat, and it starts better in Northern Ireland and disimproves. And by year four, circa... They're in the middle, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So, so we have that data. Then why is it? Where's your angle coming from? You know, in terms of tracking the mental health from secondary into third level.
So, because they're already starting, we were thinking, right, something might be happening in that year prior to the transition. So. And especially also looking at the differences between the North and South as well. So what we're looking at is in between those, trying to figure out what are those main impacts affecting student mental health during that their year preceding the transition to university. So your final year in terms of A-levels or Leaving Cert, and then also then the first two semesters of university as well to try and see what's going on. So... mainly it's trying to figure out as well, is there a difference in the education systems? As we know, there is a big discrepancy between the amount of subject you're doing in the north of Ireland versus the south of Ireland in terms of, I think you're looking at 3 to 4 subjects with, to be fair, a similar-ish amount of exams, but versus our 7 to 8 subjects here. So there is a big difference in that there to start. Personally, I think there's more pressure upon myself, but that's biased in terms of the Leaving Cert, in terms of more pressure upon that.
Yeah, I sometimes think too, and this is more of a broader thing, James, there are external circumstances, okay? So let's say, hypothetically, if you don't mind.
Of course.
If you have any anxiety issues or any mental health issues, say, for instance, any alcohol or any substance that stimulates you exacerbates that. That's a fact. And anyone who says it doesn't is talking nonsense.
Of course.
And I just wonder then, maybe for some, they put their head down and it's all books. But for others, you know, there might be more partying, more drinking. It could just be a few cans or whatever. And I'll tell you, if you are mentally vulnerable, that could be a period of time where that's all being exacerbated. It never helps. It will only ever make things work. That might not be caught in your study, but I think it's something interesting that we could look at down the line. A second thing, what is, I wonder, going on, James? Because, you know, my school years were tough. Like, they were tough. Bullying, fighting, all, none of that's present now. Very, very little of it's present now. We've never had a situation whereby it doesn't matter where you're from, what race you are, what religion you are, what gender you are. Schools have never been more supportive places, I would argue. And third level, I mean, you know, you are accepted for whatever you choose. So you would imagine, when I compare it to my childhood, that if that was the right thing for us to be doing, and I don't mean this in any ideological sense, we would be seeing far better outcomes, yet we're not. So I think... as it may not happen as part of your study, but I think beyond this, we really need to make sure that we are actually supporting young people the way they need to be supported, and not just saying whatever it is, it's fine, and leaving them without the supports that I kind of got. Do you know that sort of way?
No, I 100% agree with you. And I think you're right in the fact that there is all that support there that wasn't there even in my day. And when I finished in 2016, and comparing that to now, going back into my old school, the supports there now are amazing. And it's great to see that there, but it wasn't there when I was there. Yeah. But again, as you said, the rates are increasing though. And that is the worrying aspect of it. But even you touched on there, substance abuse in terms of exacerbating it. And even in AT Donegal, we now have a cocaine worker specifically working in AT Donegal for cocaine use. And that is just highlighting how significant that their fact is right now in there. But I think I'm going off topic here, Greg.
I'll tell you what I will very much do is bring it back into focus. Mm. It's just I do hope that when young people do reach out for help and they go, well, I'm feeling this or I want that or do the other, that we're not actually saying, well, that's fine. And we believe that's helping rather than saying, okay, well, maybe we should look at this. But that is a wider conversation. So what do you think or what do you hope in, and I presume you're looking for people to take part in this talk at this point, right? So we'll get to that in a moment.
Yeah, of course.
So what are you sort of looking to track from what year in secondary into third level? So we'll focus specifically on your work now, right?
Perfect.
So
who
are you looking to engage and what are you looking to track?
So we're looking at the whole transition, and we're looking at three different phases of viewpoints. So we've the students themselves in final year. So we've already recruited the students. So we got them last year in their final year of secondary school.
Fantastic,
so we've got about 234 students between the north and south.
Brilliant.
And we had ones down in Dublin, Mayo, and I think we got every county up the north except for Fermanagh, unfortunately. Right. Apologies, folks. But we got them now, and really what we're looking at is how baseline mental health, with kind of how you're getting on. Also looking at things like you mentioned there, I guess resilience is one of the biggest factors, because that's probably, even though negative experiences we may have had ourselves in our schooling years, they do help to a certain degree in terms of building their resilience, which is the other side of the coin. But also looking at things like, I guess, some parenting behaviours too, but also specifically looking at, I guess, what supports are available in school, looking at what practical supports, what mental health supports are available in school. Are they good? Did you benefit from them? And then also trying to figure out, I guess, what are your hopes and aspirations for going to university? Mm. Why are you looking to go there? And what concerns and worries are you mainly worried about?
So there's 200 plus then. Do you engage them continuously? They're your group,
they're
right?
My wee cohort So I've just put in now for ethics for tomorrow for our follow-up surveys, which are going to be in November and April, May time. And now what's going to be different in those, obviously, they're already going to be in transition or in their university. So we're also checking out the ones who maybe didn't go to university as well, and trying to see how their mental health, and trying to see maybe is there a discrepancy between those who didn't go to university.
I'll be really interested actually to see if resilience improves or disimproves.
Yes, I think so too. And I think it'd be interesting to see, because we're tracking also, are they moving, are they commuting? If they are commuting, how much time they spend commuting? Because recent research has highlighted the impact of commuting times. Because one, I guess, traditional student has changed. Most traditional students now are actually commuting. They're living at home. They're not living away as much. Mm-hmm. And there is studies coming out there now showing that is actually impacting upon student mental health, especially for females who are traveling for around an hour one way.
Yeah. So that's the first cohort, obviously, students.
That's the first cohort,
so parents, guardians as well?
Yes. So that's the students. We're going to follow up with them and try to see backwards as well from retrospectively, how did that transition go? And try also from qualitative interviews, see if they have any recommendations for support to put in place to try and improve that. But then, as you said, sorry, I'm going into the weeds a bit much here.
No,
Greg, apologies.
Yeah, cool. But we've got very, very clever listeners.
Thank God.
So don't worry about that, James.
But then we also then have it from educators' point of view. And from the educators' point of view, again, just trying to figure out, like, what's going on? What do they think? Because they're seeing students come in, they're seeing any differences as well, and then they're trying to get it from their perspectives. Again, what's going on with this transition? Are they already having mental health problems in secondary school? Which I personally would think so. And then they're probably being, as you said, exacerbated during that transition, potentially. But trying to figure out what's going on, what supports are there? Do they think they could be doing more? Are they doing enough? And also just trying to figure out from their perspective what could improve that. So what's the educators?
So today just about letting us know the work that you're doing? And of course, I'll be very interested to find out. Or is there anything out there in the general public that you're looking for?
Yes. So again, sorry, I've just given a big general overview, Greg, and apologies again if I'm getting getting too nitty gritty with it. But so parents is the main reason why I'm here today. So I just wanted to give you an overall view of the project as well, the UL project. But so the parents survey is the biggest thing at the minute. So we're looking at it, as I said, so the whole transition piece, just from their perspective, again, similar to educators, where I guess they're going to notice it a lot more being an outside viewer in terms of not experiencing it themselves, and just trying to figure out, I guess, what they think is the main worries and concerns. First
and
of all,
what age of the parents that might, well, will be listening, students that are in
students
secondary?
Students are just commencing. So students who are commencing to start in university this year. So any student, any parent of students who are starting university this year, you can take part. And really, it's just trying to figure out, what are your main worries and concerns about your child starting university? How prepared do you think they are? And also just assessing what supports were available in your school, what supports might have been offered by the university, and even things like practical or mental health supports as well. And also trying to get their opinion on, were they good? If they weren't, why weren't they good? And trying to, I guess, really get into, what are the main supports you think as a parent can actually help facilitate that whole transition into university?
Yeah, I'd love to as part of the study with students, and hopefully it does catch in if they were asked specifically about the pressures of the exams as they're currently formatted, to having to make decisions about what their career might be when their children, effectively no disrespect to them, and three, how aware they are of the pressures it puts on the family, many families, in terms of the actual going to, is there almost survivor's guilt when they're at college?
I think that's one of the things we capture with the parents too, because we're asking, do you have all your children in university already, trying to figure, because again, there's a lot of financial hardship associated with university, and I think it's changed, and it's very different in the north, because you have the access to the student loan.
Yeah, for sure.
So you're not going to, I guess anyone can go, where it's not as
The insights are very important. What James is looking for, he's looking to hear from parents of students making the transition. They'd love to hear from you and include your voice in what is going to be actually really important research, because there's a big cohort there. So where can people get more info?
So I have a Facebook post and I've shared it to the Highland Radio social media page. So please, if you are able to, go on to Facebook and complete the survey. The survey should take about 15 minutes, folks. And also, if anyone can't do that there, please feel free to email my lovely supervisor. I'm going to give her email address, but margaret.mclafferty@atu.ie. And if you have any questions or concerns about the study, either go on to the social media Facebook page for Highland Radio, or else email Margaret and we'll get back to you as soon as we can.
Brilliant stuff. And we'll have all that info, including Margaret's email address, on the Facebook page. James, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Rob.